you will certainly overweight them. Most of us spend very little time worrying about nuclear meltdowns or fantasizing about large inheritances from unknown relatives. However, when an unlikely event becomes the focus of attention, we will assign it much more weight than its probability deserves. Furthermore, people are almost completely insensitive to variations of risk among small probabilities. A cancer risk of 0.001% is not easily distinguished from a risk of 0.00001%. Although the former would translate to 3,000 cancers for the population of the United States, and the latter to 30. When you pay attention to a threat, you worry, and the decision weights reflect how much you worry. Because of the possibility effect, the worry is not proportional to the probability of the threat. Reducing or mitigating the risk is not adequate. To eliminate the worry, the probability must be brought down to zero. The following question is adapted from a study of the rationality of consumer valuations of health risks, which was published by a team of economists in the 1980s. The survey was addressed to parents of small children. Suppose that you currently use an insect spray that costs you $10 per bottle, and it results in 15 inhalation poisonings and 15 child poisonings for every 10,000 bottles of insect spray that are used. You learn of a more expensive insecticide that reduces each of the risks to 5 for every 10,000 bottles. How much would you be willing to pay for it? The parents were willing to pay an additional $2.38 on average to reduce the risks by two-thirds from 15 per 10,000 bottles to 5. They were willing to pay $8.09, more than three times as much, to eliminate it completely. Other questions showed that the parents treated the two risks, inhalation and child poisoning, as separate worries and were willing to pay a certainty premium for the complete elimination of either one. This premium is compatible with the psychology of worry, but not with the rational model. The fourfold pattern. When Amos and I began our work on prospect theory, we quickly reached two conclusions. People attach values to gains and losses rather than to wealth, and the decision weights that they assign to outcomes are different from probabilities. Neither idea was completely new, but in combination they explained a distinctive pattern of preferences that we call the fourfold pattern. The name has stuck. The scenarios are illustrated in Figure 13 on the PDF. The top row in each cell shows an illustrative prospect. The second row characterizes the focal emotion that the prospect evokes. The third row indicates how most people behave when offered a choice between a gamble and a sure gain or loss that corresponds to its expected value. For example, between 95% chance to win $10,000 and $9,500 with certainty. Choices are said to be risk-averse if the sure thing is preferred, risk-seeking if the gamble is preferred. The fourth row describes the expected attitudes of a defendant and a plaintiff as they discuss a settlement of a civil suit. The fourfold pattern of preferences is considered one of the core achievements of prospect theory. Three of the four cells are familiar. The fourth, top right, was new and initially surprising. The top left is the one Bernoulli discussed. People are averse to risk when they consider prospects with a substantial chance to achieve a large gain. They are willing to accept less than the expected value of a gamble to lock in a sure gain. The possibility effect in the bottom left cell explains why lotteries are popular. When the top prize is very large, ticket buyers appear indifferent to the fact that their chance of winning is minuscule. A lottery ticket is the ultimate example of the possibility effect. Without a ticket, you cannot win. With a ticket, you have a chance. And whether the chance is tiny or merely small matters little. Of course, what people acquire with a ticket is more than a chance to win. It is the right to dream pleasantly of winning. The bottom right cell is where insurance is bought. People are willing to pay much more for insurance than expected value, which is how insurance companies cover their costs and make their profits. Here again, people buy more than protection against an unlikely disaster. They eliminate a worry and purchase peace of mind. The results for the top right cell initially surprised us. We were accustomed to think in terms of risk aversion, except for the bottom left cell where lotteries are preferred. When we looked at our choices for bad options, we quickly realized that we were just as risk-seeking in the domain of losses as we were risk-averse in the domain of gains. We were not the first to observe risk-seeking with negative prospects. At least two authors had reported that fact, but they had not made much of it. However, we were fortunate to have a framework that made the finding of risk-seeking easy to interpret, and that was a milestone in our thinking. Indeed, we had identified two reasons for this effect. First, there is diminishing sensitivity. The sure loss is very aversive because the reaction to a loss of $900 is more than 90% as intense as the reaction to a loss of $1,000. The second factor may be even more powerful. The decision weight that corresponds to a probability of 90% is only about 71, much lower than the probability. The result is that when you consider a choice between a sure loss and a gamble with a high probability of a larger loss, diminishing sensitivity makes the sure loss more aversive, and the certainty effect reduces the aversiveness of the gamble. The same two factors enhance the attractiveness of the sure thing and reduce the attractiveness of the gamble when the outcomes are positive. The shape of the value function and the decision weights both contribute to the pattern observed in the top row of figure 13. In the bottom row, however, the two factors operate in opposite directions. Diminishing sensitivity continues to favor risk aversion for gains and risk seeking for losses. But the overweighting of low probabilities overcomes this effect and produces the observed pattern of gambling for gains and caution for losses. Many unfortunate human situations unfold in the top right cell. This is where people who face very bad options take desperate gambles, accepting a high probability of making things worse in exchange for a small hope of avoiding a large loss. Risk-taking of this kind often turns manageable failures into disasters. The thought of accepting the large, sure loss is too painful, and the hope of complete relief too enticing to make the sensible decision that it is time to cut one's losses. This is where businesses that are losing ground to a superior technology waste their remaining assets in futile attempts to catch up. Because defeat is so difficult to accept, the losing side in wars often fights long past the point at which the victory of the other side is certain and only a matter of time. Gambling in the Shadow of the Law. The legal scholar Chris Guthrie has offered a compelling application of the fourfold pattern to two situations in which the plaintiff and the defendant in a civil suit consider a possible settlement. The situations differ in the strength of the plaintiff's case. As in a scenario we saw earlier, you are the plaintiff in a civil suit in which you have made a claim for a large sum in damages. The trial is going very well, and your lawyer cites expert opinion that you have a 95% chance to win outright, but adds the caution, You never really know the outcome until the jury comes in. Your lawyer urges you to accept a settlement in which you might get only 90% of your claim. You are in the top left cell of the fourfold pattern, and the question on your mind is, am I willing to take even a small chance of getting nothing at all? Even 90% of the claim is a great deal of money, and I can walk away with it now. Two emotions are evoked, both driving in the same direction. The attraction of a sure and substantial gain, and the fear of intense disappointment and regret if you reject a settlement and lose in court. You can feel the pressure that typically leads to cautious behavior in this situation. The plaintiff with a strong case is likely to be risk-averse. Now, step into the shoes of the defendant in the same case. Although you have not completely given up hope of a decision in your favor, you realize that the trial is going poorly. The plaintiff's lawyers have proposed a settlement in which you would have to pay 90% of their original claim, and it is clear they will not accept less. Will you settle, or will you pursue the case? Because you face a high probability of a loss, your situation belongs in the top right cell. The temptation to fight on is strong. The settlement that the plaintiff has offered is almost as painful as the worst outcome you face, and there is still hope of prevailing in court. Here again, two emotions are involved. The sure loss is repugnant, and the possibility of winning in court is highly attractive. A defendant with a weak case is likely to be risk-seeking, prepared to gamble rather than accept a very unfavorable settlement. In the face-off between a risk-averse plaintiff and a risk-seeking defendant, the defendant holds the stronger hand. The superior bargaining position of the defendant should be reflected in negotiated settlements, with the plaintiff settling for less than the statistically expected outcome of the trial. This prediction from the fourfold pattern was confirmed by experiments conducted with law students and practicing judges, and also by analyses of actual negotiations in the shadow of civil trials. Now consider frivolous litigation, when a plaintiff with a flimsy case files a large claim that is most likely to fail in court. Both sides are aware of the probabilities, and both know that in a negotiated settlement, the plaintiff will get only a small fraction of the amount of the claim. The negotiation is conducted in the bottom row of the fourfold pattern. The plaintiff is in the left-hand cell, with a small chance to win a very large amount. The frivolous claim is a lottery ticket for a large prize. Overweighting the small chance of success is natural in this situation, leading the plaintiff to be bold and aggressive in the negotiation. For the defendant, the suit is a nuisance, with a small risk of a very bad outcome. Overweighting the small chance of a large loss favors risk aversion, and settling for a modest amount is equivalent to purchasing insurance against the unlikely event of a bad verdict. The shoe is now on the other foot. The plaintiff is willing to gamble, and the defendant wants to be safe. Plaintiffs with frivolous claims are likely to obtain a more generous settlement than the statistics of the situation justify. The decisions described by the fourfold pattern are not obviously unreasonable. You can empathize in each case with the feelings of the plaintiff and the defendant that lead them to adopt a combative or an accommodating posture. In the long run, however, deviations from expected value are likely to be costly. Consider a large organization, the City of New York, and suppose it faces 200 frivolous suits each year, each with a 5% chance to cost the city $1 million. Suppose further that in each case, the city could settle the lawsuit for a payment of $100,000. The city considers two alternative policies that it will apply to all such cases, settle or go to trial. For simplicity, I ignore legal costs. If the city litigates all 200 cases, it will lose 10, for a total loss of $10 million. If the city settles every case for $100,000, its total loss will be $20 million. When you take the long view of many similar decisions, you can see that paying a premium to avoid a small risk of a large loss is costly. A similar analysis applies to each of the cells of the fourfold pattern. Systematic deviations from expected value are costly in the long run, and this rule applies to both risk aversion and risk seeking. Consistent overweighting of improbable outcomes, a feature of intuitive decision making, eventually leads to inferior outcomes. Speaking of the fourfold pattern. He is tempted to settle this frivolous claim to avoid a freak loss, however unlikely. That's overweighting of small probabilities. Since he is likely to face many similar problems, he would be better off not yielding. We never let our vacations hang on a last-minute deal. We're willing to pay a lot for certainty. They will not cut their losses so long as there is a chance of breaking even. This is risk-seeking in the losses. They know the risk of a gas explosion is minuscule, but they want it mitigated. It's a possibility effect, and they want peace of mind. Chapter 30. Rare Events. I visited Israel several times during a period in which suicide bombings in buses were relatively common, though of course quite rare in absolute terms. There were altogether 23 bombings between December 2001 and September 2004, which had caused a total of 236 fatalities. The number of daily bus riders in Israel was approximately 1.3 million at that time. For any traveler, the risks were tiny, but that was not how the public felt about it. People avoided buses as much as they could, and many travelers spent their time on the bus anxiously scanning their neighbors for packages or bulky clothes that might hide a bomb. I did not have much occasion to travel on buses, as I was driving a rented car, but I was chagrined to discover that my behavior was also affected. I found that I did not like to stop next to a bus at a red light, and I drove away more quickly than usual when the light changed. I was ashamed of myself, because of course I knew better. I knew that the risk was truly negligible, and that any effect at all on my actions would assign an inordinately high decision weight to a minuscule probability. In fact, I was more likely to be injured in a driving accident than by stopping near a bus. But my avoidance of buses was not motivated by a rational concern for survival. What drove me was the experience of the moment. Being next to a bus made me think of bombs, and these thoughts were unpleasant. I was avoiding buses because I wanted to think of something else. My experience illustrates how terrorism works and why it is so effective. It induces an availability cascade. An extremely vivid image of death and damage, constantly reinforced by media attention and frequent conversations, becomes highly accessible, especially if it is associated with a specific situation, such as the sight of a bus. The emotional arousal is associative, automatic, and uncontrolled, and it produces an impulse for protective action. System 2 may know that the probability is low, but this knowledge does not eliminate the self-generated discomfort and the wish to avoid it. System 1 cannot be turned off. The emotion is not only disproportionate to the probability, it is also insensitive to the exact level of probability. Suppose that two cities have been warned about the presence of suicide bombers. Residents of one city are told that two bombers are ready to strike. Residents of another city are told of a single bomber. Their risk is lower by half, but do they feel much safer? Many stores in New York City sell lottery tickets, and business is good. The psychology of high-prize lotteries is similar to the psychology of terrorism. The thrilling possibility of winning the big prize is shared by the community and reinforced by conversations at work and at home. Buying a ticket is immediately rewarded by pleasant fantasies, just as avoiding a bus was immediately rewarded by relief from fear. In both cases, the actual probability is inconsequential. Only possibility matters. The original formulation of prospect theory included the argument that highly unlikely events are either ignored or overweighted. But it did not specify the conditions under which one or the other will occur, nor did it propose a psychological interpretation of it. My current view of decision weights has been strongly influenced by recent research on the role of emotions and vividness in decision-making. Overweighting of unlikely outcomes is rooted in System 1 features that are familiar by now. Emotion and vividness influence fluency, availability, and judgments of probability, and thus account for our excessive response to the few rare events that we do not ignore. Overestimation and overweighting. What is your judgment of the probability that the next president of the United States will be a third-party candidate? How much will you pay for a bet in which you receive $1,000 if the next president of the United States is a third-party candidate and no money otherwise? The two questions are different, but obviously related. The first asks you to assess the probability of an unlikely event. The second invites you to put a decision weight on the same event by placing a bet on it. How do people make the judgments, and how do they assign decision weights? We start from two simple answers, then qualify them. Here are the oversimplified answers. People overestimate the probabilities of unlikely events. People overweight unlikely events in their decisions. Although overestimation and overweighting are distinct phenomena, the same psychological mechanisms are involved in both: focused attention, confirmation bias, and cognitive ease. Specific descriptions trigger the associative machinery of System 1. When you thought about the unlikely victory of a third-party candidate, your associative system worked in its usual confirmatory mode, selectively retrieving evidence, instances, and images that would make the statement true. The process was biased, but it was not an exercise in fantasy. You looked for a plausible scenario that conforms to the constraints of reality. You did not simply imagine the fairy of the West installing a third-party president. Your judgment of probability was ultimately determined by the cognitive ease or fluency with which a plausible scenario came to mind. You do not always focus on the event you are asked to estimate. If the target event is very likely, you focus on its alternative. Consider this example. What is the probability that a baby born in your local hospital will be released within 3 days? You were asked to estimate the probability of the baby going home, but you almost certainly focused on the events that might cause a baby not to be released within the normal period. Our mind has a useful capability to focus spontaneously on whatever is odd, different, or unusual. You quickly realized that it is normal for babies in the United States, not all countries have the same standards, to be released within 2 or 3 days of birth. So your attention turned to the abnormal alternative. The unlikely event became focal. The availability heuristic is likely to be evoked. Your judgment was probably determined by the number of scenarios of medical problems you produced, and by the ease with which they came to mind. Because you were in confirmatory mode, there is a good chance that your estimate of the frequency of problems was too high. The probability of a rare event is most likely to be overestimated when the alternative is not fully specified. My favorite example comes from a study the psychologist Craig Fox conducted while he was Amos's student. Fox recruited fans of professional basketball and elicited several judgments and decisions concerning the winner of the NBA playoffs. In particular, he asked them to estimate the probability that each of the 8 participating teams would win the playoff. The victory of each team in turn was the focal event. You can surely guess what happened, but the magnitude of the effect that Fox observed may surprise you. Imagine a fan who has been asked to estimate the chances that the Chicago Bulls will win the tournament. The focal event is well defined, but its alternative, one of the other 7 teams winning, is diffuse and less evocative. The fan's memory and imagination, operating in confirmatory mode, are trying to construct a victory for the Bulls. When the same person is next asked to assess the chances of the Lakers, the same selective activation will work in favor of that team. The 8 best professional basketball teams in the United States are all very good, and it is possible to imagine even a relatively weak team among them emerging as champion. The result? The probability judgments generated successively for the 8 teams added up to 240%. This pattern is absurd, of course, because the sum of the chances of the 8 events must add up to 100%. The absurdity disappeared when the same judges were asked whether the winner would be from the Eastern or the Western Conference. The focal event and its alternative were equally specific in that question, and the judgments of their probabilities added up to 100%. To assess decision weights, Fox also invited the basketball fans to bet on the tournament result. They assigned a cash equivalent to each bet, a cash amount that was just as attractive as playing the bet. Winning the bet would earn a payoff of $160. The sum of the cash equivalents for the 8 individual teams was $287. An average participant who took all 8 bets would be guaranteed a loss of $127. The participants surely knew there were 8 teams in the tournament and that the average payoff for betting on all of them could not exceed $160, but they overweighted nonetheless. The fans not only overestimated the probability of the events they focused on, they were also much too willing to bet on them. These findings shed new light on the planning fallacy and other manifestations of optimism. The successful execution of a plan is specific and easy to imagine when one tries to forecast the outcome of a project. In contrast, the alternative of failure is diffuse, because there are innumerable ways for things to go wrong. Entrepreneurs and their investors who evaluate their prospects are prone both to overestimate their chances and to overweight their own estimates. Vivid outcomes. As we have seen, prospect theory differs from utility theory in the relationship it suggests between probability and decision weight. In utility theory, decision weights and probabilities are the same. The decision weight of a sure thing is 100, and the weight that corresponds to a 90% chance is exactly 90, which is 9 times more than the decision weight for a 10% chance. In prospect theory, variations of probability have less effect on decision weights. An experiment that I mentioned earlier found that the decision weight for a 90% chance was 71.2, and the decision weight for a 10% chance was 18.6. The ratio of the probabilities was 9.0, but the ratio of the decision weights was only 3.83, indicating insufficient sensitivity to probability in that range. In both theories, the decision weights depend only on probability, not on the outcome. Both theories predict that the decision weight for a 90% chance is the same for winning $100, receiving a dozen roses, or getting an electric shock. This theoretical prediction turns out to be wrong. Psychologists at the University of Chicago published an article with the attractive title, Money, Kisses, and Electric Shocks, on the affective psychology of risk. Their finding was that the valuation of gambles was much less sensitive to probability when the fictitious outcomes were emotional, meeting and kissing your favorite movie star, or getting a painful but not dangerous electric shock, than when the outcomes were gains or losses of cash. This was not an isolated finding. Other researchers had found, using physiological measures such as heart rate, that the fear of an impending electric shock was essentially uncorrelated with the probability of receiving the shock. The mere possibility of a shock triggered the full-blown fear response. The Chicago team proposed that affect-laden imagery overwhelmed the response to probability. 10 years later, a team of psychologists at Princeton challenged that conclusion. The Princeton team argued that the low sensitivity to probability that had been observed for emotional outcomes is normal. Gambles on money are the exception. The sensitivity to probability is relatively high for these gambles because they have a definite expected value. What amount of cash is as attractive as each of these gambles? A. 84% chance to win $59. B. 84% chance to receive one dozen red roses in a glass vase. What do you notice? The salient difference is that question A is much easier than question B. You did not stop to compute the expected value of the bet, but you probably knew quickly that it is not far from $50. In fact, it is $49.56. And the vague estimate was sufficient to provide a helpful anchor as you searched for an equally attractive cash gift. No such anchor is available for question B, which is therefore much harder to answer. Respondents also assessed the cash equivalent of gambles with a 21% chance to win the two outcomes. As expected, the difference between the high probability and low probability gambles was much more pronounced for the money than for the roses. To bolster their argument that insensitivity to probability is not caused by emotion, the Princeton team compared willingness to pay to avoid gambles. 21% chance, or 84% chance, to spend a weekend painting someone's three-bedroom apartment. 21% chance, or 84% chance, to clean three stalls in a dormitory bathroom after a weekend of use. The second outcome is surely much more emotional than the first, but the decision weights for the two outcomes did not differ. Evidently, the intensity of emotion is not the answer. Another experiment yielded a surprising result. The participants received explicit price information along with a verbal description of the prize. An example could be 84% chance to win a dozen red roses in a glass vase, value $59. 21% chance to win a dozen red roses in a glass vase, value $59. It is easy to assess the expected monetary value of these gambles, but adding a specific monetary value did not alter the results. Evaluations remained insensitive to probability even in that condition. People who thought of the gift as a chance to get roses did not use price information as an anchor in evaluating the gamble. As scientists sometimes say, this is a surprising finding that is trying to tell us something. What story is it trying to tell us? The story, I believe, is that a rich and vivid representation of the outcome, whether or not it is emotional, reduces the role of probability in the evaluation of an uncertain prospect. This hypothesis suggests a prediction in which I have reasonably high confidence, although my predictions are often wrong. Adding irrelevant but vivid details to a monetary outcome also disrupts calculation. Compare your cash equivalents for the following outcomes. 21% or 84% chance to receive $59 next Monday. 21% or 84% chance to receive a large blue cardboard envelope containing $59 next Monday morning. The new hypothesis is that there will be less sensitivity to probability in the second case, because the blue envelope evokes a richer and more fluent representation than the abstract notion of a sum of money. You constructed the event in your mind, and the vivid image of the outcome exists there, even if you know that its probability is low. Cognitive ease contributes to the certainty effect as well. When you hold a vivid image of an event, the possibility of its not occurring is also represented vividly and overweighted. The combination of an enhanced possibility effect with an enhanced certainty effect leaves little room for decision weights to change between chances of 21% and 84%. Vivid probabilities. The idea that fluency, vividness, and the ease of imagining contribute to decision weights gains support from many other observations. In a classic experiment, the psychologist Seymour Epstein gave participants a choice of drawing a marble from one of two urns in which red marbles win a prize. Urn A contains 10 marbles, of which one is red. Urn B contains 100 marbles, of which 8 are red. Which urn would you choose? The chances of winning are 10% in urn A and 8% in urn B, so making the right choice should be easy, but it is not. About 30% to 40% of students choose the urn with the larger number of winning marbles rather than the urn that provides a better chance of winning. Epstein presented his result as evidence of the superficial processing that is characteristic of System 1, which he calls the experiential system. As you might expect, the remarkably foolish choices that people make in this situation have attracted the attention of many researchers. The bias has been given several names. Following Paul Slovic, I will call it denominator neglect. If your attention is drawn to the winning marbles, you do not assess the number of non-winning marbles with the same care. Vivid imagery contributes to denominator neglect, at least as I experience it. When I think of the small urn, I see a single red marble on a vaguely defined background of white marbles. When I think of the larger urn, I see 8 winning red marbles on an indistinct background of white marbles, which creates a more hopeful feeling. The distinctive vividness of the winning marbles increases the decision weight of that event, enhancing the possibility effect. Of course, the same will be true of the certainty effect. If I have a 90% chance of winning a prize, the event of not winning will be more salient if 10 of 100 marbles are losers than if 1 of 10 marbles yields the same outcome. The idea of denominator neglect helps explain why different ways of communicating risks vary so much in their effects. You read that a vaccine that protects children from a fatal disease carries a 0.001% risk of permanent disability. The risk appears small. Now consider another description of the same risk. 1 of 100,000 vaccinated children will be permanently disabled. The second statement does something to your mind that the first does not. It calls up the image of an individual child who is permanently disabled by a vaccine. the 99,999 safely vaccinated children have faded into the background. As predicted by denominator neglect, low probability events are much more heavily weighted when described in terms of relative frequencies, how many, than when stated in more abstract terms of chances, risk, or probability, how likely. As we have seen, System 1 is much better at dealing with individuals than categories. The effect of the frequency format is large. In one study, people who saw information about a disease that kills 1,286 people out of every 10,000 judged it as more dangerous than people who were told about a disease that kills 24.14% of the population. The first disease appears more threatening than the second, although the former risk is only half as large as the latter. In an even more direct demonstration of denominator neglect, a disease that kills 1,286 people out of every 10,000 was judged more dangerous than a disease that kills 24.4 out of 100. The effect would surely be reduced or eliminated if participants were asked for a direct comparison of the two formulations, a task that explicitly calls for System 2. Life, however, is usually a between-subjects experiment in which you see only one formulation at a time. It would take an exceptionally active System 2 to generate alternative formulations of the one you see and to discover that they evoke a different response. Experienced forensic psychologists and psychiatrists are not immune to the effects of the format in which risks are expressed. In one experiment, professionals evaluated whether it was safe to discharge from the psychiatric hospital a patient, Mr. Jones, with a history of violence. The information they received included an expert's assessment of the risk. The same statistics were described in two ways. Patients similar to Mr. Jones are estimated to have a 10% probability of committing an act of violence against others during the first several months after discharge. Of every 100 patients similar to Mr. Jones, 10 are estimated to commit an act of violence against others during the first several months after discharge. The professionals who saw the frequency format were almost twice as likely to deny the discharge, 41%, compared to 21% in the probability format. The more vivid description produces a higher decision weight for the same probability. The power of format creates opportunities for manipulation, which people with an axe to grind know how to exploit. Slovic and his colleagues cite an article that states that approximately 1,000 homicides a year are committed nationwide by seriously mentally ill individuals who are not taking their medication. Another way of expressing the same fact is that 1,000 out of 273 million Americans will die in this manner each year. Another is that the annual likelihood of being killed by such an individual is approximately 0.00036%. Still another. 1,000 Americans will die in this manner each year, or less than 1/30th the number who will die of suicide, and about 1/4th the number who will die of laryngeal cancer. Slovic points out that these advocates are quite open about their motivation. They want to frighten the general public about violence by people with mental disorder, in the hope that this fear will translate into increased funding for mental health services. A good attorney who wishes to cast doubt on DNA evidence will not tell the jury that the chance of a false match is 0.1%. The statement that a false match occurs in one of 1,000 capital cases is far more likely to pass the threshold of reasonable doubt. The jurors hearing those words are invited to generate the image of the man who sits before them in the courtroom being wrongly convicted because of flawed DNA evidence. The prosecutor, of course, will favor the more abstract frame, hoping to fill the jurors' minds with decimal points. Decisions from global impressions. The evidence suggests the hypothesis that focal attention and salience contribute to both the overestimation of unlikely events and the overweighting of unlikely outcomes. Salience is enhanced by mere mention of an event, by its vividness, and by the format in which probability is described. There are exceptions, of course, in which focusing on an event does not raise its probability. Cases in which an erroneous theory makes an event appear impossible even when you think about it, or cases in which an inability to imagine how an outcome might come about leaves you convinced that it will not happen. The bias toward overestimation and overweighting of salient events is not an absolute rule, but it is large and robust. There has been much interest in recent years in studies of choice from experience, which follow different rules from the choices from description that are analyzed in prospect theory. Participants in a typical experiment face two buttons. When pressed, each button produces either a monetary reward or nothing, and the outcome is drawn randomly according to the specifications of a prospect. For example, 5% to win $12, or 95% chance to win $1. The process is truly random, so there is no guarantee that the sample a participant sees exactly represents the statistical setup. The expected values associated with the two buttons are approximately equal, but one is riskier, more variable than the other. For example, one button may produce $10 on 5% of the trials, and the other $1 on 50% of the trials. Choice from experience is implemented by exposing the participant to many trials in which she can observe the consequences of pressing one button or another. On the critical trial, she chooses one of the two buttons, and she earns the outcome on that trial. Choice from description is realized by showing the subject the verbal description of the risky prospect associated with each button, such as 5% to win $12, and asking her to choose one. As expected from prospect theory, choice from description yields a possibility effect. Rare outcomes are overweighted relative to their probability. In sharp contrast, overweighting is never observed in choice from experience, and underweighting is common. The experimental situation of choice by experience is intended to represent many situations in which we are exposed to variable outcomes from the same source. A restaurant that is usually good may occasionally serve a brilliant or an awful meal. Your friend is usually good company, but he sometimes turns moody and aggressive. California is prone to earthquakes, but they happen rarely. The results of many experiments suggest that rare events are not overweighted when we make decisions such as choosing a restaurant or tying down the boiler to reduce earthquake damage. The interpretation of choice from experience is not yet settled, but there is general agreement on one major cause of underweighting of rare events. Both in experiments and in the real world, many participants never experience the rare event. Most Californians have never experienced a major earthquake, and in 2007, no banker had personally experienced a devastating financial crisis. Ralph Hertwig and Ido Erev note that chances of rare events, such as the burst of housing bubbles, receive less impact than they deserve according to their objective probabilities. They point to the public's tepid response to long-term environmental threats as an example. These examples of neglect are both important and easily explained. But underweighting also occurs when people have actually experienced the rare event. Suppose you have a complicated question that two colleagues on your floor could probably answer. You have known them both for years and have had many occasions to observe and experience their character. Adele is fairly consistent and generally helpful, though not exceptional on that dimension. Brian is not quite as friendly and helpful as Adele most of the time, but on some occasions he has been extremely generous with his time and advice. Whom will you approach? Consider two possible views of this decision. It is a choice between two gambles. Adele is closer to a sure thing. The prospect of Brian is more likely to yield a slightly inferior outcome, with a low probability of a very good one. The rare event will be overweighted by a possibility effect favoring Brian. It is a choice between your global impressions of Adele and Brian. The good and the bad experiences you have had are pooled in your representation of their normal behavior. Unless the rare event is so extreme that it comes to mind separately, Brian once verbally abused a colleague who asked for his help. The norm will be biased toward typical and recent instances favoring Adele. In a two-system mind, the second interpretation appears far more plausible. System 1 generates global representations of Adele and Brian, which include an emotional attitude and a tendency to approach or avoid. Nothing beyond a comparison of these tendencies is needed to determine the door on which you will knock. Unless the rare event comes to your mind explicitly, it will not be overweighted. Applying the same idea to the experiments on choice from experience is straightforward. As they are observed generating outcomes over time, the two buttons develop integrated personalities to which emotional responses are attached. The conditions under which rare events are ignored or overweighted are better understood now than they were when prospect theory was formulated. The probability of a rare event will, often, not always, be overestimated because of the confirmatory bias of memory. Thinking about that event, you try to make it true in your mind. A rare event will be overweighted if it specifically attracts attention. Separate attention is effectively guaranteed when prospects are described explicitly. 99% chance to win $1,000 and 1% chance to win nothing. Obsessive concerns, the bus in Jerusalem, vivid images, the roses, concrete representations, one of 1,000, and explicit reminders, as in choice from description, all contribute to overweighting. And when there is no overweighting, there will be neglect. When it comes to rare probabilities, our mind is not designed to get things quite right. For the residents of a planet that may be exposed to events no one has yet experienced, this is not good news. Speaking of rare events, tsunamis are very rare even in Japan, but the image is so vivid and compelling that tourists are bound to overestimate their probability. It's the familiar disaster cycle. Begin by exaggeration and overweighting, then neglect sets in. We should focus on a single scenario, or we will overestimate its probability. Let's set up specific alternatives and make the probabilities add up to 100%. They want people to be worried by the risk. That's why they describe it as one death per 1,000. They're counting on denominator neglect. Chapter 31. Risk Policies. Imagine that you face the following pair of concurrent decisions. First, examine both decisions, then make your choices. Decision 1. Choose between A, sure gain of $240, B, 25% chance to gain $1,000 and 75% chance to gain nothing. Decision 2. Choose between C, sure loss of $750, D, 75% chance to lose $1,000, and 25% chance to lose nothing. This pair of choice problems has an important place in the history of prospect theory, and it has new things to tell us about rationality. As you heard the two problems, your initial reaction to the sure things, A and C, was attraction to the first and aversion to the second. The emotional evaluation of sure gain and sure loss is an automatic reaction of System 1, which certainly occurs before the more effortful and optional computation of the expected values of the two gambles, respectively, a gain of $250 and a loss of $750. Most people's choices correspond to the predilections of System 1, and large majorities prefer A to B and D to C. As in many other choices that involve moderate or high probabilities, people tend to be risk-averse in the domain of gains and risk-seeking in the domain of losses. In the original experiment that Amos and I carried out, 73% of respondents chose A in Decision 1 and D in Decision 2, and only 3% favored the combination of B and C. You were asked to examine both options before making your first choice, and you probably did so. But one thing you surely did not do, you did not compute the possible results of the four combinations of choices, A and C, A and D, B and C, B and D, to determine which combination you like best. Your separate preferences for the two problems were intuitively compelling, and there was no reason to expect that they could lead to trouble. Furthermore, combining the two decision problems is a laborious exercise that you would need paper and pencil to complete. You did not do it. Now consider the following choice problem. AD, 25% chance to win $240 and 75% chance to lose $760. BC, 25% chance to win $250 and 75% chance to lose $750. This choice is easy. Option BC actually dominates option AD, the technical term for one option being unequivocally better than another. You already know what comes next. The dominant option in AD is the combination of the two rejected options in the first pair of decision problems, the one that only 3% of respondents favored in our original study. The inferior option BC was preferred by 73% of respondents. Broad or narrow? This set of choices has a lot to tell us about the limits of human rationality. For one thing, it helps us to see the logical consistency of human preferences for what it is, a hopeless mirage. Have another look at the last problem, the easy one. Would you have imagined the possibility of decomposing this obvious choice problem into a pair of problems that would lead a large majority of people to choose an inferior option? This is generally true. Every simple choice formulated in terms of gains and losses can be deconstructed in innumerable ways into a combination of choices, yielding preferences that are likely to be inconsistent. The example also shows that it is costly to be risk-averse for gains and risk-seeking for losses. These attitudes make you willing to pay a premium to obtain a sure gain rather than face a gamble, and also willing to pay a premium in expected value to avoid a sure loss. Both payments come out of the same pocket, and when you face both kinds of problems at once, the discrepant attitudes are unlikely to be optimal. There were two ways of construing decisions 1 and 2. Narrow framing, a sequence of two simple decisions considered separately. Broad framing, a single comprehensive decision with four options. Broad framing was obviously superior in this case. Indeed, it will be superior, or at least not inferior, in every case in which